BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show Friday Drive Time with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. This week, claims and counterclaims still rumble on about the Easter disturbances in Stokes Croft. We hear what some local people, including a former policeman, saw on the nights in question and what lessons they think can be learned. Plus, whole countries are now up for auction to the highest bidder. Is that the inevitable consequence of the IMF bailouts? And arguably the world's most powerful secret society meets next weekend in St. Moritz in Switzerland. But don't be surprised if you don't hear much about it on the TV or on the radio or read about it in the newspapers, except maybe for The Guardian. The media bosses attending this year's 120-man Bilderberg conference are sworn to secrecy. But before all that, the German government has announced this week their final nuclear power station will close by the end of the decade. What does that mean for our planned nuclear power stations here in Hinkley and Albury? Well, I'm joined on the telephone by Crispin Aubrey from the Stop Hinkley campaign. Hi, Crispin, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony.
First of all, what do you make of the German announcement?
Well, I think it's very significant. I mean, it's been a result, a direct result of the accident at Fukushima in Japan. First of all, they shut down some of their older nuclear power stations almost immediately after the accident. And now the government has reaffirmed its policy of shutting all nuclear power stations, as you say, by 2022 and moving even faster towards renewable energy. I think the significance of it is that the Germans aren't just taking an anti-nuclear stance. They're showing that they have the potential to replace nuclear and fossil fuels with clean renewables. And they're very serious right across the board on renewable energy. And remember, this is, as I said, the fourth largest economy, so it is very significant.
Okay, so what does it mean, though, for Albury? Because I know it's a German firm that's planning to build the new Albury nuclear power station.
Possibly more significance, direct significance for Albury than Hinkley. Albury, the consortium planning to build there is called Horizon, but it's actually a consortium of two German electricity companies, RWE and E.ON. E.ON obviously sells electricity in this country. And very interestingly, a representative from the Albury campaigning group, Shepherdine Against Nuclear Energy, went to the last AGM of RWE, and there was a massive presence there of anti-nuclear people, both him coming from this country and people from Germany. And the board gave him 2 or 3 minutes to say his piece in Germany about why Albury should not be, why they shouldn't build a new power station at Albury. So I think that the Horizon Consortium would be much less keen to go ahead. They were always uncertain about it. And I think this pressure in Germany could well make a difference to them. Hinkley may be a different situation because EDF is a French company where they've continued to be very pro-nuclear even after Fukushima.
Now, if the Germans decided that nuclear power is actually not going to be economic, how come Britain is still pressing ahead with it?
It's a very good question. I mean, before the coalition government came into existence, the Liberal Democrat Party had a policy of moving towards 100% renewable energy by 2050 and not building any new nuclear power stations. Now, Chris Huhne, who is still at this moment the Energy Secretary, signed up to that policy. So I think that the German decision will be sending reverberations through all the sort of closet anti-nuclear MPs, both in the Liberal Democrat Party and in other parties. So I think it will strengthen their case. So there will be certainly a lot of debate at the political level, and one can only hope that it will slow down the march of EDF towards building the power station at Hinkley. One other factor is that after Fukushima, it's almost certain they're going to have to introduce some additional safety measures. and that again will make it, will delay it and make it more expensive to, for them to build the power station.
Hang on a minute, Crispin, because we don't have a fault line at Hinkley or Oldbury, do we?
Well, no. Well, there wasn't a fault. What happened at Fukushima was, first of all, an earthquake, and we don't have earthquakes of that type. Then there was a tsunami. It was a combination of the two. There has actually, in the 17th century, there was a tidal wave that hit the coast at Hinkley and spread inland for about 3 or 4 miles. So something approaching a tsunami is possible. But the point is, what the Fukushima accident has shown, that despite the assertions by the Japanese authority that it could withstand all the things that they were prepared for, it was built in an earthquake zone, it didn't. And the cooling and shutdown systems did not work successfully. The same potential sequence of events could happen at Hinkley, not perhaps fired up by these particular problems, but by some other problem with power supply. I was reminded that back in the 1980s, Hinkley B, the only power station still working at Hinkley, actually lost all its mains grid power, and for about half an hour, the backup generators, the diesel generators that would keep the electricity supply, they didn't work either. So these sequence of events, similar to what happened at Fukushima, are possible at European power stations, and we shouldn't build them for that reason.
Now, sorry to spring this one on you, but the last time we were talking about this subject, a couple of months ago, we had a report which was in the Western Daily Press and other papers up around Gloucester, that actually there'd been quite a complete shutdown at Oldbury, and terrible sort of grinding, screeching noises coming out of the Oldbury existing power station. Have you any idea what that was?
I don't actually, I'm afraid, Tony, I don't have details on that. I know there was a serious incident at Oldbury. I think, but I'm afraid you'd have to ask the Oldbury campaigners for the details on that. I think the fact is that there are often crisis situations which don't necessarily, obviously don't lead to anything like Fukushima, but nuclear power stations have many more problems than you might anticipate. I mean, the ones we've got in this country are obviously quite old. But if you go to France, where they've got a sort of newer generation, certainly not as old as Oldbury, a lot of them, there are problems all the time. I mean, there was one in a lot of them are built inland near rivers, and one of them in the south of France, there was actually a leak of radioactive material from it into an area where they were growing wines, and the local wine growers decided as a result of that incident to change the name on the label of their bottles because they were so nervous of being associated with a radioactive leak. So there's a lot of stuff that goes on that we don't necessarily hear about.
Okay, and now you're also, as part of the Stop Hinkley campaign, planning a blockade of Hinkley Power Station in October. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's a one-day event on October the 3rd. We're hoping to get people coming from Bristol, especially, but from all over the country, to support a statement that we would that we don't want this new Hinkley C power station to go ahead. It's going to be a one-day protest at the power station. We think it's important to focus on the site itself, to say that that Fukushima has now given a clear message that even sort of 25 years after Chernobyl beginning to fade in people's memories, there are still massive dangers involved in nuclear power. So yes, we're looking for a mass presence on that day, and we hope anybody who wants to get involved will keep an eye on the Stop Hinkley website, stophinkley.org, and find out the latest details on how it's actually going to be organised.
Crispin Aubrey from Stop Hinkley, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Well, we move now to have a look at the policing of the Easter disturbances in Stokes Croft and the issues surrounding the way we buy our food in general, and Tesco's in particular. First, to lay out the context of this, I've tried to get someone from Avon and Somerset Police to come on to put the Avon and Somerset Police community relations point of view, but after initially being promised by Chief Superintendent John Stratford that he was free today to come in, we've since been informed by Neve Byrne at Avon and Somerset Police's Corporate Communications Department in Portishead, not only can John Stratford not come tonight, but no nobody from the force is available to speak. And I quote, many thanks for your offer, but unfortunately there will be no possibility of someone being available to take part in discussions on your drive time show. Those were the words of Niamh Byrne at the Avon and Somerset Police headquarters in Portishead. Well, I also asked Fleur Davis at Tesco's Public Relations if she would like their spokesman, Michael Kissman, or anyone else to put Tesco's point of view tonight. She initially expressed an interest, but then did not return my calls. So we've been forced to discuss the issue with neither Tesco's nor the police live here in the studio, unfortunately. Avon and Somerset Police Force have about 6,000 employees, about 1,000 of which are based in the Bristol district. Their annual budget for the whole force is around £250 million, and the Chief Constable is Colin Port, who ultimately takes responsibility for the operation to police Stokescroft over Easter. On the early hours of Good Friday, it seems Superintendent Ian Wiley was the officer in operational command of the 160 Riot Police. In the Guardian shortly after, he had this to say. There have been several significant incidents in this building during the past few days, which have caused serious concerns to police and local residents. He's talking about the famous now squat telepathic heights on Stokescroft. The safety of the public is paramount in a situation of this kind, and we took the decision to carry out a robust and swift operation following intelligence received about the criminal intentions of those who were occupying the building. Well, I'm now joined by Paul Wheatcroft, who works in Stokescroft and is himself a former policeman at Avon and Somerset. Paul, welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, Tony. Thanks for inviting me.
First of all, what exactly is your connection with Stokescroft?
Well, I do work there, I suppose, but not for money. I've got a studio in Hamilton House, which is that amazing old 70s office block. There's about 100 artists in there, and I'm one of them.
What about your former career as a policeman? How long did you serve, and when did you retire?
Well, I joined Bristol Police, which is a different constabulary to Avon and Somerset, in 1966, and I retired in 1998.
And so what were you doing? What kind of policing and whereabouts in the city? Or were you all over the place? Or can you just take us on a little tour of your career?
Well, I'll try as best I can remember. I worked at... the first police station I worked at was Eastfield, which, of course, has been long gone. But then St George, Lochlea's for 10 years. And when I worked at Lochlea's, we covered Gloucester Road right down to Cheltenham Road Arches. So I was a local bobby down in Bishopston for 7 years. Covering Pigsty Hill and the area not very far from Stokescroft.
So what were your connections with these disturbances? Were you actually able to witness them yourself, or have you just been picking up stuff from people you've been working with?
I wasn't there on the Thursday evening, the first dispute over the Tesco shop. But Friday morning I was there, Good Friday morning I was there, organising a portrait painting event. And I was very impressed to see Chris Chalkley and other local residents sweeping up and with shovels and wheelie bins. And
he's from the People's Republic of Stokescroft, which is just over in Jamaica Street.
That's right, in that lovely shop selling all that pottery and stuff. And I had a chat with a number of people down there. A lot of people were very upset about what had happened, but also a lot of people were very happy that Tesco's was closed, and including myself, actually, because I'm not very keen on corporates invading that part of Bristol or anywhere, I suppose, really. We've got far too many Tesco's in Bristol, I think. So the atmosphere on the Friday morning was one of shock and surprise, but also quite a cooperative approach as well, in terms of wanting to clear the place up and get back to normal.
But as a former policeman, as a professional yourself, what do you think of the way that some of the allegations about the very serious allegations about a petrol bomb were dealt with? Because this is what the police are saying, is that they really needed to have a very, very strong force in there because of the seriousness of the possible outcome of having someone having a petrol bomb.
Sure. It's a very difficult situation, really, and I'm not in possession of facts about any of the events, rightly so, because I'm not in the police anymore myself. But I think there is a tendency to overreact. I remember back in the 70s when shield training was being discussed, and I went for my shield training, and I was the only officer who spoke out against shields because I thought they were provocative. And I think there is a sense of officers in helmets and visors and carrying shields, which I've done myself in the St. Paul's riot, is not a good thing, and it's also very scary for the officers themselves, because you don't know if you're going to have petrol thrown at you. You don't know if you're going to be hit with a brick. And the local bobby in Stokes in St. Paul's in 1981 was hit on the head with a brick, and he's never been the same since. And he was the local policeman doing his best with the community. So rumours kick off, and unfortunately, I think one of the things that I've heard is, which probably was a mistake, was the Welsh police coming over, because they couldn't possibly have known anything about the area, and they probably came over thinking they were just going to be meeting a large violent mob, which is not the that is not what Stoatscroft is. Stoatscroft is a mixture of very intelligent, thinking, caring people, actually.
And what about the one of the points that I've kept hearing about this whole business is that people, a lot of people actually turned up to be kind of witnesses to what was going on, and then ended up actually being targeted by the police, because the police were moving, and then they would decide. I mean, for example, we had the MP Kerry McCarthy on here saying that a photographer who was a member of her party who was with her was actually attacked by the police as part of this. So what's the what's your thought about the way that it seems that people who weren't actually involved in any way in this whole accusation of a petrol bomb were just kind of caught up anyway?
Well, yeah, I mean, I know that feeling myself, and I think if you're fearful, then I think you will sometimes not act in the best way possible. And I think sometimes there just isn't time in a heated situation to actually assess who it is you're talking to, whether they're a decent person or a troublemaker. And I think that's part of the problem, really. But in the 80s, I remember there was an animal rights march which began on the Downs and marched all the way down Blackboy Hill and Park Street to the university laboratories. And all the way, I was in uniform, and I walked next to a guy who was on the march. And I was a vegetarian at the time, and so was he, obviously. And we talked all the way down, and it was a really good... You know, I felt very close to this guy, and then we had to separate, obviously. But you don't... How many times can you do that? Sometimes you just can't do that, and... We only act out of fear or love, and I think in a riot situation, police officers are going to act out of fear and the unknown, really. So I'm not condoning it at all, you know, but it's difficult. It's very, very hard to get the facts in these situations. It really is very difficult, I think.
Do you think that there has been a bit of a breakdown in trust between the police in the Stoatscroft area? Because certainly people I've spoken to around there, and I went to a public meeting a couple of weeks ago where there was a lot of anger being poured out. Now, do you think that there's any kind of justification for that? Because the police are simply there doing their job, ultimately. And as you were saying yourself, that riot shields can be provocative, but then actually, ultimately, a shield is just there as a shield to protect you.
Well, it's a good point. Well, on the Tuesday after the riot, the 3rd of May, I was in Cafe Kino, and I was astonished to see a police officer sitting at a table in the cafe with his helmet on the desk, writing his notes up, drinking a cup of coffee. And I went over and I said to him, this is amazing. I'm so pleased to see you here. And he said, well, it's easy, isn't it? I can sit here and if the public want to speak to me, they can. So I think we'd be nice to get back to some of those old ideas, which is what I did back in the 80s.
But Paul, it's very, very different. The local community police to having 160 riot police coming in from, many of whom are actually from outside the area.
Well, that's the other extreme, really. I mean, good intelligence on the ground is achieved by officers gaining the trust of local people. But I mean, you know, on the other side of it, the police are not enforcing all the parking on the pavement that goes on in Stoatscroft. Somebody is ignoring that because they realise that the community needs to deliver it. So, you know, it's difficult to get it right all the way around, really. I think mob handed on both sides is not an easy situation to get clarity on, really.
Now, Martin Summers is also here with us. Martin, now you've said that you think that in past weeks on here that there may have been an overreaction by the police. What do you think from what you've heard, what Paul's been saying?
I think this all stems from this alleged petrol bomb incident, which I understand that the lad that's been charged with this is coming to court shortly, and hopefully his court appearance will clarify a lot of things, and we will know what the intelligence was, why the decisions were taken, and so on. But just initially, I've certainly had reports from Labour Party colleagues who were actually beaten that night, full-time Labour Party workers beaten by police officers. They've not put a formal complaint in, but they were certainly hit. And in fact, they said, look, I'm a full-time Labour Party worker, don't do that. I think the other problem is the timeline of all of this. What I understand from gossiping to people, and again, it is only gossip, was that local community police said to the protesters outside Tesco's 2 days before all of this kicked off, that people further upstairs at Avon and Somerset were insisting that they should be harassed, that they should be nicked for anything, that something had to be done about the Tesco's protest.
This is a sort of picket outside Tesco's, which are...
They said that's not going to happen because that's the kind of relationship that the police had with the protesters, but they said, heads up, something may happen. And then something did. Now, we've got to find out where, when, and how any petrol bomb was there. And even if there was a petrol bomb there, I question whether the tactics of bringing in three out-of-town riot squads at 9 o'clock in the evening, when you've been told there's a petrol bomb at 3 in the afternoon, so you've waited 6 hours before you bring all these people in. There's got to be a question mark about that, because it was bound to lead to some kind of face-off at that time of day. There's no doubt about that. What worries me is the possibility, and I'll put it no stronger than this, that somebody senior in Avon and Somerset was colluding with Tesco's to kind of create an incident which would then discredit the protests and so on. Now, I'm not saying that's what happened. I'm just saying that is a perspective that some people are taking on this. And I think we need to investigate it properly. I mean, that's why we have courts. That's why there's going to be a court appearance for the lad that's been... Because the lad who was charged with making the petrol bombs was definitely not in the squat at the time. And he wasn't arrested inside the squat. So I'm going to be interested to see what the police come up with in terms of linking him to this petrol bomb, which, of course, we haven't seen yet. And don't forget, there were generators inside the squat, I understand. So petrol cans might well be around the place because they've got a generator. But anyway, I think the attitude in Stokescroft has been shock and horror, but also one of we want to get back to normal with our local police officers. Mm. And I think that's been very much the mood that I've been picking up.
So Paul,
and there are protesters now outside Tesco's peacefully protesting. Mm. That's the way it's got to
stay. Is that fair, Paul?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is. I mean, I'm not here to represent the police. I really not, you know, because I've always been a bit, I suppose, slightly rebellious when I was in the job. So, so I'm not. I can't talk about evidence because I don't know anything about it. But one thing I do know is that where you have a large community of people who use Stokescroft, who are, you know, university educated and passionate about all sorts of things, whether it, you know, all sorts of things loosely around about freedom, you're going to get some conflict. And I think personally, that's no threat to me. I don't worry about that. I think that's a good thing, that we should have these energies in our community. So but of course there's an establishment which sometimes finds that sort of thing difficult. You've only got to look at the number of bicycles in Stokescroft to realize that you've got a lot of individuals down there who are looking for change. And that's, you know, at the end of the day, we always end up talking after any disturbances and listening, which is even more important. We should give each other a damn good listening to.
That's a very good phrase.
Now, Marina Morris has been out on the streets this week on the Tesco topic, and she's also been asking you what you think about the violence. And she actually went up to Stokescroft to record this.
What do you think about the violence?
I don't really agree with violence, but at the same time I understand why people are angry, and I can't really condone it. Fair enough if people feel that strongly, as long as they don't hurt people too much.
Well, violence is a kind of a loaded term. I would like to start with like making a distinction between violence against property and violence against people. I think that's a really important difference there. I absolutely support what happened. I think it's fantastic that people are not going to stand for it, basically. So many communities this has happened to, like, all over the country, and people haven't had the kind of agency to take matters into their own hands like that. And I think as a tactic, like, property damage is totally legitimate in this context. Absolutely, I totally support it.
Although I only live around the corner, I didn't participate in the protest. And as far as the violence goes, well, maybe the police did come down a bit heavy-handed and there were people who react, but it's hard to say, really, when it comes to sort of protests and riots. Chicken and egg situation, really. You get an angry crowd and then you get law enforcement and then they sort of become the target for the anger. Bit of a storm in a teacup at the end of the day, though. It was all done in a day, wasn't it? So, I mean, there was no smashed windows, there was no petrol bombs, and I feel sorry for the policemen who obviously got clobbered a little bit, but they'll all be getting compensation for their injuries. And nobody got seriously hurt, I don't think. Was there anyone seriously hurt?
Yeah, I'm quite angry about that, because we've kept up a lot of the night on two occasions. I sort of missed work one day, and I don't think it was... representative of everybody here. A lot of people are in favour of it.
Police provoked it. Pure and simple, they shut a major road and then basically kettled a load of people who were going about their business late on a night. So they're in a situation where if you push someone who's drunk, yeah, you're going to get them violent. It's like we live in a police state.
Situations like that provide people with an opportunity to express anger that's inside them that may be related to what's happening, but it stems from something deeper. Maybe it's not good for people to, you know, break windows or get violent, but there's so many bad things in the world, it's better for people to say something than not to say anything.
That was Marina Morris out on the streets of Bristol last week, talking to, actually Stokes Croft specifically, talking to you about what you thought about the policing of the Easter disturbances. I'm joined by Paul Wheatcroft, who's a former policeman at Avon and Somerset. Actually, no, you said, was it from Bristol District when it was something?
No, I joined Bristol Constabulary, yeah.
Bristol Constabulary, yeah, that sounds like something from the 1800s. Yeah. anyway, what were your thoughts about these, what he was, some people there were saying, talking about this whole kettling business. Was that done in your day?
No, definitely not. No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't. So I don't know what to say about that. I mean, it doesn't sound very nice to me. And, you know, police horses and stuff like that, they're pretty big and horrible. So I think the best thing just go home or get out of the way or something, you know, make your protest in a way where you're not going to risk getting hurt because things get out of control. That's the trouble. Things
people
get
in the Stokescroft area really aren't the types to just go home, are
no,
they? That's the
not.
Trouble. They will stand there and watch almost as witnesses. And in fact, I think in many ways we can commend the MP Kerry McCarthy for actually having the oomph to come up and actually witness what was going on, even though it wasn't actually part of her constituency because her constituency boundaries were changed. Well, I'm also joined by John Peters Coleman, who's a presenter on the Dialect programme at sort of sister show of this one in some ways, which is broadcast on BCFM at 3 o'clock on Sundays. John, you were there on the second of the two disturbances. Can you just tell us what happened and how you actually got involved? Were you on the way somewhere?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'd gone out for the evening and I'd passed a few people that I knew, sort of friends, acquaintances. There's a lot of familiar people in the Stokescroft area who were generally hanging around, and the police were there, and I went on to the Lakota nightclub because I thought, well, there's no real reason for me to be here. There's plenty of other people here already. About midnight or so, I wanted to go back home. And I managed to walk through the crowd, and at that point, nothing particularly was happening. And I walked up past some of the pubs and the bars. There's a lot of people who live there, who are in the pubs having a night out, having a drink, having a fag in the street, observing what's going on. And on passing through, when I chatted to a couple of people on the way up, they're like, the atmosphere was, well, there's going to be a riot. There hadn't actually been a riot at that point. Particularly, there were lots of people and lots of police.
Well, that almost makes it sound like that it was the local people who were determined to have a riot.
Well, no, it wasn't so much that. It was more just an expectation. If riot police turn up, people say, oh, well, there's going to be a riot. So, but there wasn't actually anything too violent happening at that stage. But when I got up towards the top of the road by the Polish church, I heard this almighty great panic and fluster of people running up the street behind me, all sorts of screaming and horses. So I turn around, and there's loads of people running up the road. So I kind of stopped and turned around and thought, well, I'll video this because there's something going on. And what I always recommend to anybody to do in that situation is, you know, is video it. Video what's going on.
A lot of people have got video cameras on their phones nowadays, haven't they?
Yes, that's correct.
That's what you're talking about.
And from experience, because I went into that not having really done anything like that before, I naively just sort of went in sort of fairly boldly and just sort of videoed fairly obviously. It's just video a little discreetly and talk to other people who are videoing and say, look, if I see any riot police being violent with you, if you have a camera, don't worry, I will video you, and then you do the same for me. And you can actually talk with other people and sort of formulate a simple plan just to have a lot of passive people on the sidelines just videoing everything. And I think that will actually help to make riot police actually stop and think. Because as I heard you earlier on saying, in that situation, they do panic. They're in like lots of big, heavy, fluorescent clothing with a visor and a massive shield on a very warm evening, and there's lots of people pushing and shoving and shouting. And you can't, I'm not confident that I can actually tell what's going on half of the time, apart from there are a lot of violent, angry people in front of them.
So you started filming as the police, and I imagine were they on horseback too, coming towards you?
Well, all I could see was an awful lot of people coming towards me at first. The police were behind them, and I didn't see them for a minute. But I interviewed a couple of people and said, explain to me, what's going on? And I said, well, basically, we're all sitting around peacefully, and then all of these riot coppers just sort of rammed shields into us and started whacking people over the head, like, fairly indiscriminately. And I immediately thought, well, all of my friends and people that I know and acquaintances are all down the bottom of the road. So I immediately felt its urge, like, I've got to go down and find out if they're okay or what's going on. So I head further down the road and I think, well, I'm not doing or saying anything you know, wrong, at all violent. I'm not even so much as, you know, flicking a visa on or anything. I don't see why I should, you know, necessarily be involved in this. So I walked down the road holding my video camera, just videoing my progress as I went down. And a line of police came towards me, and I stood up on a traffic island because they didn't say or make any manoeuvres which indicated that they objected to me. Nobody sort of shouted, you know, turn around. They didn't sort of push me with a shield or anything. So I simply stood on the traffic island to let them pass. And as a couple of police officers drew up either side of me out of the view of the camera as they sort of walked past me, they then turned around when they couldn't obviously be seen by my camera and started battening my legs very hard, which I was obviously extremely shocked about because I wasn't expecting it. And what I would say is, you know, other people have written on their blogs that they photographed what happened and were lucky enough to meet someone who said, oi mate, you know, you better watch out because you're not safe just because you're not a protester, because you're not doing being violent. Unfortunately, I didn't meet anybody who said that, and being naive, not obviously usually walking through a riot zone on my way home, I wasn't to know that. But I would recommend, like, you know, do video, don't let me what I'm saying stop you, but do be very wary that they will attack people if they are being filmed. Riot police do not like being filmed.
Well, Paul Wheatcroft here, a former policeman, this isn't normal behaviour for the police, is it? And surely there's no guidelines that the police are supposed to adhere to which says that as you've just gone past someone with a camera that you then start truncheoning them from the back of the legs.
Well, no, of course not. I mean, I think what is Peter, isn't it?
John.
I think what John's saying about members of the public recording activity, I think is one sure way that everything is going to change dramatically, because no officer, and they should all be wearing their numbers, and they should be really clear, no officer is going to want to be filmed, and you know, it'll be evidence doing something wrong. And I suppose in a way all this is on the cusp of democracy in a way, isn't it? You know, you've got a long established police service which goes back to 1836, and it's there to sort of maintain the status quo. And you've got a wonderfully educated population in Bristol and in Britain challenging and wanting change, and you've got this old-fashioned approach really which is trying to safeguard something which is actually a little bit out of date. And to me it's a big issue. It's not just something that happens on Stokes Croft one night. It's a much bigger story really.
It's interesting you say it's on sort of the fringe of democracy, because I mean, I would say, you know, to video something like that, it's definitely in the public interest.
Yes, I agree with you.
It's not necessarily to catch out or in a sort of snide way the police, but it's actually making them stop and think. It's like, well, hang on, I'm on camera. Because one point, when I walked further up the road, a man had his baton raised, and there were a couple of people talking to him in front of him, and I could see that he'd seen me out the corner of his eye and stopped. And I thought, well, my being there has actually, although it looks unremarkable, because people are wanting to see police violence when they log on, I think, which is part of the reason why I didn't kind of want to show it to too many people. It actually, you know, more to the point, if I'm videoing, it actually stopped him from hitting somebody who wasn't actually doing anything violent.
Sure. And also the incident in London where the fire extinguisher was thrown from the top of a building, almost hitting a police officer.
Incredibly
so, it's, you know, it's there for both sides, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
And really, nobody really wants to get injured. And nobody really wants anyone else injured, do they, in those situations? I mean, it's okay to hate the police. And, you know, as a police officer, ex-police officer myself, we were just used to being hated. And football duty was the classic one, you know, where everybody turns on the uniform. And
I think
that's
it's
just the way it is, you know.
To sort of say
you don't join unless you can take a joke.
Yeah. I mean, police covers a very broad heading, though. I mean, there's the riot police, the ordinary police, and the community support officers.
Yeah,
and the people
they're all the same guys, really.
Well, I feel sorry for the police community support officers, because they're different from the riot police. They have a different function, and they have to take all the flack for what the riot police get up to the previous night and the previous week. You know, they're just there to sort of be on the floor, be on the pavement, bobby on the beat, and collect intelligence. The riot police, that's not their job.
Well, thank you very much, Paul Wheatcroft, former policeman, and John Peters Coleman. Now, I'll be joined by Elizabeth Winkler, who's a food writer and part of the Stop Tesco group, after we've heard our last vox pop from Marina Morris. This time she asks, are you happy with how the police behave?
Are you happy with how the police behaved?
Not really, but at the same time they have to protect the people. Maybe they didn't need that many people, but if there was violence, then what, they had to come in, or people would accuse them of not doing their job. I wouldn't say I'm happy with it, but I don't think that they did anything that wrong. Apart from, I heard that they had quite a lot of bad press about evicting the people near Tesco's.
I was abroad and I saw it made international news, and I saw some footage abroad, but you just got to be careful with how they edit that sort of thing and exactly what they're showing. So again, I can't really comment on that.
The way that the police reacted was totally over the top. This is kind of the bohemian area of Bristol. Like, you don't have to be a genius to know that like 160 riot cops, like armed to the teeth, are gonna cause like a lot of aggro in the area, basically.
No, they were quite provocative. I think they could have handled it in a better way. They were provocative when we were watching at Picton Street. It was, yeah, I think it was a bit heavy-handed. Yeah.
No, never. I'm sorry. As far as I'm concerned, the police are here to protect those in positions of power and wealth in this country, and everyone else can go hang. And as for the riot, as far as I'm concerned, the police pushed a riot from a non-residential area into a residential area and then tried to blame the local, which is out of order. Not to mention, half a dozen people with head injuries that were just going about their business.
Well, that was you. At least if you live in the Stokes Croft area, Marina Morris was out and about chatting to people there this week for this programme. I'm now joined, after we heard from Paul Wheatcroft and John Peters-Colmer, by Elizabeth Winkler, who's a food writer and part of the Stop Tesco group. Now, Liz, first of all, you were there on the second of those two disturbances. Can you just tell us what you felt about the causes of it and the way it was policed?
Okay, well, I, from talking to people who were there on both nights, it seemed like what happened on the second Thursday was different than the first Thursday. I did go down as a witness, really. I went down about midnight. And I was aware that there was a kind of mix. I thought it was a really good point what someone said here, that you get a mixture of police, and police vary. So I did see a bit of kind of macho policing, but I also saw some very human policing. I also saw, I mean, my fellow campaigners and I, we saw some, it looked like the lads out for a bit of, you know, like what Gus Hoyt, the Green Councillor, calls the riot tourists. I think I would say that there was that element. But, you know, you've got the helicopter, which is drawing people to that place, and the whole scene is spotlighted by the helicopter's beam, and it's almost like a theatre. And I think it does draw people who, I mean, it's so unusual that people come down and there is spectacle. And so, as I said, when I was, there were a couple of incidences where my co-campaigners in the group were saying to some, well, they look quite young, I would say they were sort of, it's really hard to tell, but they look kind of youth. We were saying, put the dustbin down, you know, don't throw the bottles. And then one kid did put the dustbin down. I don't know if it was a kid or not, but one guy did put the dustbin down, the recycling with the bottles.
And I know a lot of the people who have been arrested have actually been very young, you know,
right.
Sort of, you know, in their late teens, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is it doesn't totally surprise me, but I think I suppose what you're trying to do is to stop Tesco people, is to sort of restrain the more, shall we say, feisty element amongst the protesters, the people who are the more macho side. And in a way, it seems like you've got this sort of macho side amongst the protesters, and you've also got this macho side in the police.
Yeah, that's quite possible, and it's possible also that both I thought it was brilliant what the ex-policeman said. I thought that was very interesting, and I felt that was my observation as well, that both, it's a scary adrenaline pumping situation, and both some members of the police and some members of the public, they get this kind of fear and flight thing, and they start kind of lashing out. This, as far as I can see, and I think everyone needs to learn to calm down and not overreact like that.
So why, let's get cut to the chase here, why do you want to stop Tesco?
Okay, well, there's so much to say, I don't even know where to start. Firstly, the area that Tesco has chosen, Stokes Croft, as we've heard, is a very unusual, unique area that has been regenerating itself from the grassroots up over the last 10 years. And the work that's been done there is tremendous. And it's not everyone's cup of tea, but I happen to love it. It's vibrant, it's unusual, it's quirky.
But aren't you fighting a losing battle? Because really, Tesco's is almost like an unstoppable force. It's a massive multinational. It's got a plan to get as much of a market share in that area as possible.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree with you more. Tesco is huge. In fact, I've been campaigning since February 2010. What I've learnt about Tesco, I thought I knew and understood the might of Tesco. What I've learnt is that it's more mighty than I had realised.
Well, give us a couple of nuggets that you've learnt over those last year or so.
The whole planning process about how local council, our elected councillors, cannot say, look, we don't want Tesco's. We want to protect our own local businesses and our local communities. That is not permissible in planning law. The other thing I learnt was that there was an attempt by the Monopolies Commission in 2009 to try and restrain supermarkets, to say, look, if you've got 60% of the market share locally, and locally was 10 minutes in a car, then we don't think you should be in that area. Okay, that's quite, I thought that was really reasonable. Well, Tesco appealed and won.
Pulled a few strings up at the central government.
Lot of strings. And the other thing I heard recently was mostly Birmingham. There was also, I mean, this was anecdotal and I haven't checked it out, but someone said that, who were in the area, said that that councillors were actually threatened by a Tesco spokesperson to say, we will personally sue you. Now, that's anecdotal. I haven't checked it out. But I think it just gives a sense of, although Tesco on the outside, if you go into a shop, it looks like a kind of, you know, it's convenient, it's clean, it's calm, there's nothing, you know, it just looks like an ordinary shop. I think what's behind Tesco is something, it is a mighty force. It's almost like the new kings, the new powers, the new kings,
food barons or something. Anyway, Martin Summers, has capitalism hit the buffers? Because nobody can compete with a Tesco shop. If they open up, well, yes, but with these big supermarkets, whoever they open up next to just goes bust. That's not competition.
No, I think this is the problem. You see, there is a natural tendency towards monopoly in most markets. The bigger you are, the lower your unit costs are, and you're basically, the bigger you are, the more likely you are to succeed. And therefore, there is a tendency to monopoly in all markets, including a retail market, where you'd have thought there wouldn't be much of an advantage. And if you're building aircraft or something, you could imagine that building on a large scale is obviously necessary, technically necessary. But in the 80s, Tesco lobbied to get rid of resale price maintenance. So previously, you know, basically a loaf of bread or a pint of milk had to be sold at its cost of production or more. But of course, they lobbied to get rid of that so that they can then go move into an area, sell milk and bread cheaper than the locals until they've forced them out of business, and then they move in with all the other stuff that they want to sell. Now, this is actually an anti-competitive practice, which is why it was banned. But they've got such political power that they can actually get that overturned. And then of course, they get bigger still and they can do other things. And I don't think people may not remember in the 1980s, Dame Shirley Porter, who was running Westminster Council, she was the Tesco's heiress.
I mean, she was a Conservative councillor.
She was
a Conservative leader of the council,
but basically she had to run away to Israel in the end, where she now lives, because she was ultimately being done for fraud and under representation of the People's Act, because she was sold off the cemeteries for a pound to a friend of hers in Westminster, and she was selling off council housing stock to yuppies in order to try and gerrymander
to move Labour voters out.
Yes, they've got a track record of bullying behaviour.
Well, back to you, Liz Winkler from Stop Tesco.
Just going back to, I think it's interesting that Tesco rose to its sort of superpowers with New Labour, actually, and that's been quite well documented. Mm-hmm. That there was a kind of happy marriage between New Labour and Tesco getting bigger and bigger. So just to put it in a bigger, wider political context.
So what are you doing in the face of all of this, Liz, as part of the group?
Okay, well, I also want to say, you know, you were talking about the power of the retailer. I mean, I just feel, as someone who cares very much about food, I just feel outraged that this is everyone needs to eat, and it's so important, our food supplies, and who controls it. And although at the moment it looks like, oh well, friendly Tesco, you know, every little helps, all the, you know, billions that go into the marketing messages, you don't really want to get to a point where you can only shop in Tesco for your food. That, I think, makes a city, makes a community very vulnerable. So sorry, your question was, what are we doing about it? Okay, well, we have, right along the way, we have, you know, we have tried to address it, obviously legally, and we've been addressing the minutiae of the planning process and also raising awareness. And we are going to, we applied for judicial review. Coincidentally, the timing of the rejection came actually between those two Thursdays, but however, we rallied and we have managed to get an appeal. And to celebrate the appeal, we are going to have a No Tesco Tea Party, and that will be on Monday the 13th of June, from just for 1 hour, all love, good-humoured, like we've always done. Music, bring cake to share, bring your musical instruments, dress up in fancy dress. This is a family-friendly event from 5 to 6 p.m. in front of Tesco's on Cheltenham Road on Monday the 13th.
There's not a lot of space on the pavement just there, is
there?
No,
that's right. We are in contact with the local police. The local police, you know that we protest peacefully and good-humouredly, and we're talking about, well, if there are a lot of people, what would we do, and how we would make sure that we had two lanes open so that traffic could go either way. We feel confident we can do that.
And what about the idea of having some sort of shop to compete with, and so Tesco's doesn't get any customers and has to close down?
Well, I think our main purpose is that's exactly what we're doing. We don't want to just be putting our energies into saying no, stop. We are also creating a positive alternative, and the positive alternative is to have an affordable food co-op, and we're in discussions. There's nothing nothing official yet, but it's all bubbling away, and we hope to be able to announce something soon.
Well, Liz Winkler from Stop Tesco, is there a website or anything? Or,
yes.
And you also give us the web address of your blog, blog.
Thank you. Well, if you Google Real Food Lover, hopefully that will take you to my blog. And the address, and the web address is you Google No Tesco in Stokes Croft, and that should also get you to the website.
Liz, thanks ever so much for joining us.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Now, new conditions are being demanded by the IMF in the latest series of bailouts, which could put an end to 3,000 years of history in Greece as an independent state. Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert report from their show on the satellite channel Russia Today and Freeview.
People of Greece have moved, you see, from indifference. Their sovereignty is being taken away from them. In Spain, of course, now, they're saying, they're asking themselves, why are we letting the global bankers do the DSK on us?
Well, you know, some might have thought it was hyperbole to call it banker occupation, but check out this first headline, Max. Greece. Shocking new bailout conditions mean the end of national sovereignty. Yes, apparently the big news from Greece this week, that is, in order for the country to qualify for future bailouts, they are going to actually have to hand over to outside authorities the function of collecting taxes.
As we've been saying on this show from the beginning, the objective of the IMF, which is controlled by the US, which is controlled by Wall Street, is to simply grab all of Greece's assets for pennies on the dollar and to annex the entire country of Greece, and that they should forego their sovereignty and their independence. Now they're just one more ride on Disneyland. Congratulations, Greece. You're now insignificant. Your entire 5,000-year history just got flushed down the toilet.
Well, those leading the charge include bankers and politicians from the Netherlands and also the Germans. So it takes me to this next headline. The Fed's secret giveaway to European banks. As Reuters says, file under things you never knew the Fed did during the financial crisis. An $80 billion loan scheme known as St. Omo, which was so obscure that even Barney Frank had no idea it existed when he required the Fed to turn over its lending data in the Dodd-Frank bill. So it turns out that the Fed was making loans, extremely cheap loans, of as little as 0.01%, when at the Fed's main bank window, they were charging 0.5%. But most of these loans went to Credit Suisse, $45 billion, and Deutsche Bank, which is now being bailed out on the backs of the Greeks. But the fact is that these banks who are now occupying Greece would not even be alive if it were not for the rearming and the re-giving of ammunition, of weapons to these banks by the U.S. taxpayer who is backing the Fed,
that's
ultimately.
Right. That's right. The money comes from the U.S. taxpayer.
Yeah.
That's right. So, and the U.S. taxpayer, by the way, is 50 million unemployed.
That's an extract from the Kaiser report on Russia Today. Martin Summers, this first point that they're making there, that the taxes are now going to be collected from the IMF rather than from the Greek government. This sounds like a bit of a change in Greece. And is it true that that's the end of Greece as an independent state?
Well, I mean, it's a struggle, isn't it? I mean, how do you have your independence? You've got to remember that there was a coup against the democratically elected government of Greece in 1973. It was in the 60s, wasn't it? And that was backed by the Americans, and the Greeks remember that very well. They were occupied by the Germans during the war. They suffered terribly. And it's the German banks, private banks, to which most of this money is now owed. And a lot of Greeks are saying, well, hang on a minute. Who owes what who? Who to what here?
So what about this Federal Reserve secret loan of $80 billion to Deutsche Bank and Credit Suisse?
Yeah, but what you've got there is the US state taxpayers bailing out the Western, the European banks, but on the understanding that they can then go into Greece and get their pound of flesh. It won't work, of course, because Greece is actually is being pushed into debt deflation, and in debt deflation they won't be able to pay their debts. But of course, what's actually happening now is a bank robbery or a robbery. They're going to try and get as many assets out of the Greeks at pennies on the dollar, as he said, as possible before the whole thing crashes. And we're going to end up with a situation where a tiny minority will own all the assets on the planet. We're moving there already, and everybody else will be left with nothing. But that is a revolutionary situation, and Greece knows all about that.
Well, the annual G8 conference passed off with no big fuss last weekend in France. At least that's what coverage in the British press would have you believe. But Dmitry Medvedev, who's the Prime Minister of the newest member, Russia, held a press conference at the end of the meeting where he explained that NATO is pushing us all into a new arms race in Europe with its so-called missile defence shield.
Well, I have no secrets from you, especially on a simple issue as missile defense. So far, I'm not very much satisfied with the U.S. response to my suggestions. The response of all NATO countries. Why? Because we're wasting time. And I'd like to have our concerns heard. What are our concerns? First and foremost, we need to have guarantees that it is not targeted against us. So far, nobody's provided such guarantees. They keep telling that there are some bad countries that might be source of threat. But when we ask, name those countries, they're silent. Then we ask, name the threats. Do they have missiles? Do they want to intercept? No, they don't have missiles. Who is the country that has the missiles? Well, we do. Then the conclusion is very simple, and it is targeted against us. I mentioned that recently already, and unfortunately in that sense, we have not advanced. But of course, we've agreed to continue large-scale consultations, aiming to try and find the basis for an agreement.
Well, these missile defence shield, the Russians are saying, is targeted against them, Martin, are they right?
Well, who else is it targeted against? I mean, there was a pretense that it was supposed to be defending Western Europe against Iran, and what Putin said, well, why don't you put it in Azerbaijan, right next to Iran? Then, oh, no, we want to have it in Poland. Why?
Well,
why? Because it's basically brinkmanship by NATO.
The annual Bilderberg conference kicks off next week in the Swiss resort of St. Moritz. It's no easy task to discover where these annual conferences are taking place, before the event, as the 120 bankers, royalty, oil barons, genetics and technology bosses, key politicians and a darling of the world's business community, Henry Kissinger, do everything they can to stop both us and the press finding out. But a handful of selected press managers and journalists, though, who willingly sign up to Bilderberg's code of secrecy, such as Marcus Agius, a former banker who's now trustee at the BBC, and Rupert Murdoch's chief executive, and reporters from The Economist magazine, are not allowed to report anything that's said there. Martin, briefly, can you just sum up what you think of the Bilderbergers? Who are these people?
Well, you know more than I, Tony. I mean, you've been running a website about them for many, many years. I see the Bilderberg conference as a bit like a gypsy horse fair. The politicians go along so that the financial people can have a look at their fetlocks
but
and their teeth
be doing. Surely
and
the
decide which ones they want to buy.
If the politicians are there, voted there in our interest, they shouldn't be there, should they?
No, they shouldn't, especially when it was, until recently, it was all completely secret and nobody knew who was there or why they were there. And in fact, Tony Blair famously said he never went when he did. Now, why is he lying about that?
Well, the thing that bothers me about it more than anything else is that it was started by an ex-SS officer, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who was actually kicked out as chairman of Bilderberg in 1975 when he was caught with a $1 million bribe from Lockheed. Anyway, we will be covering that next week, we hope. Thanks very much to our guests in the first hour, Lib Dem councillor for Redland, Fee Hance, also to food writer and stopper of Tesco, Elizabeth Winkler, and a former policeman, Paul Wheatcroft, and also to Dialect's co-presenter, John Peters Coleman, to Old Labour Oxford economist you just heard there, Martin Summers. Next week, we dare to report on the biggest secret of the political world in the West, NATO's annual Bilderberg Conference, which attracts the richest and most powerful bankers, royalty and the rest. And if you're on broadband internet, you can hear all our previous Friday drive times, including this show, at www.thisweek.org.uk. See you next week.
CFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody...